You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This, of course, is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today is the 23rd of November 2022, meaning, of course, that tomorrow is the American holiday of Thanksgiving. The first thing I want to do is thank my listeners and readers. My book, The Ontology of Death, is doing extremely well. It ranked among both Christian history and metaphysics. It was number 9 in new releases. So I'm anxious to see what that's going to mean financially in the future. And I appreciate you guys not just buying it, but also reviewing it right there on Amazon. Today, of course, you know, we begin by appealing for assistance, although I know that's becoming more and more difficult, and I fully understand this. Whether it be direct donations or buying, joining my Patreon account, all of which are available right on the Orthodox Nationalist site or on RusJournal.org, and Radio Albion in general. So, I want to talk about someone, Henri Bergson, who I have never even mentioned on this show before. And it's a little surprising that I would be dealing with him. But he was one of the people that Seraphim Rose said snapped him out of the materialist dogma. And he went from there to Evola and a few others. Now, Bergson is not in that category. However, he is an eccentric and, in my opinion, a very strong existentialist philosopher. Not particularly Christian in his outlook, but you have to understand the defeatist attitude in France. You know, he's writing at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. He dies, I think, in 1941. But he saw the results of the Industrial Revolution. The results of it were pretty clear. The rule of a global oligarchy and an obsession with production and high tech. And when that's driven for profit, you have a grinding down of the individual personality. He's challenging materialism. Now, let's be clear what we're talking about by that term. Materialism means that everything we perceive, in fact, everything that exists as far as we can tell, is made up of matter or a direct product of matter. And they are the same thing. Because matter can only give birth to itself. Materialism is, in fact, a universal. It's non-scientific because there's no way to demonstrate it without already presuming it. And this is a dogmatic kind of materialism where it's not just that, well, the only thing that science can talk about is material cause and effect. That's certainly true. No, it goes farther than that. It's a metaphysical statement that everything is matter, including consciousness. Simon Frank, who we spoke of, I guess, earlier this year, a lot of the Russians in this period of time really used consciousness as an antipode to materialism. Consciousness doesn't make any sense in the materialist universe. It's easy to forget that prior to World War I, the materialist ideal was everywhere. This was the wave of the future, as was the Soviet Union. French intellectuals, many Americans, many Englishmen, many Germans were taken by the official propaganda concerning the Soviet system in Lenin and Stalin. It was, in fact, fashionable. Capitalism and Marxism have materialism in common. I guess we can say that a capitalist doesn't necessarily have to believe that everything is made of matter, but that the important things are. Spirit may exist, but that has nothing to do with industrialization. And that's exactly the proposition that Bergstrom wants to challenge. He's fallen out of favor. He was a huge writer. I mean, clearly there was an interest in France on the turn of the century for a challenge to the industrial mind. We call it a revolution on purpose. You know, revolution isn't just a change in government. It's a complete, or at least the attempt, to remake an entire society. So a revolution, by its very structure, is totalitarian. There's nothing that's left out of it. And we've come across this topic with different writers over the last, since I started this in 2009. Materialism is something today taken for granted. It's not as if someone's going to tell you, yes, everything is made of matter. Now, normally when you talk about materialism, the popular definition is someone who only cares about money and social position. Well, that might be true, but that's not the actual functional definition of the term. The idea that everything that exists in the world is matter, or somehow based on matter, and therefore spirit and freedom, because those two things go together, don't exist. Thomas Hobbes laid the grounding for this, the end of the Renaissance, the very beginning of modernity, and in fact, Hobbes created modernity roughly around the same time that the Spanish Armada was defeated, which is extremely important because two of them went together. A lot of the Russian religious tradition holds to the view that consciousness can't be material. Consciousness is, in fact, a universal object, and the one object that we have immediate and undoubted access to. Now, it's my opinion that materialism, whether it be implied or explicit, I think the bulk of Americans are materialists in both senses of the term. They don't know how to state it. They don't know how to make an argument about it, because you really can't argue it. You have to assume it. It's simply something that's implied by their existence. They define, I'm talking about the masses, the American mass, they define happiness, virtue, success, contentment, satisfaction, whatever term they're going to use, with gains in their financial world. But up until a certain point, someone with money has done something great to earn it. And there's a few exceptions, you know, the Paris Hilton kind of people. But in general, they see an upper middle class person, they call him successful. They don't qualify it by saying financially successful. They just say successful. And of course, the worst thing that could possibly happen to them is therefore unemployment and a huge economic downturn. And the only good thing about that is that if you attach your personality to that concept of materialism, and the regime doesn't deliver the goods, in fact does the opposite, then the result can be extremely disconcerting. When your whole life, you know, when I was in college, how many of these kids were saying, well, I'm here not to learn anything, but I'm here to get some kind of foundational qualification for a career later on, or a job later on. As we explain Bergson's anti-materialist agenda, keep that in mind, the idea that the material world is, if not the only thing in existence. And you could stop short of making that categorical statement. But materialists do that. You know, Marx did it. Hobbes did it. So many of these others, you know, a lot of the anarchists did it. You don't have to say that everything is material, but the things that matter, the things that everyone else says that matters, those things are material. Everything else is a matter of private life, which is in and of itself a revolutionary change, that the spiritual life is private, the material life is public. Consciousness doesn't make sense in a materialist world. The life of animals, which do not have freedom and do not have reason, they have a very rudimentary logic, but they don't progress. You know, they don't have a literature or anything else. They could use very simple tools under controlled circumstances. But everything goes by instinct. There's a lot of people, the old existentialist escape from freedom is to live a life entirely by instinct. And not only is that easy, not only does it remove all the responsibility, but it eliminates one of the most burdensome things that human beings have to deal with, and that is choice. We've been here before, in fact, very recently. The other thing that materialists have to say is that everything that exists today in the natural world in 2022 had to have existed in one, at least potential form, at the very beginning of time. Mechanism can't create anything new. It's the old architect idea. Only God creates ex nihilo, or from nothing. The Masonic architect has to deal with already existing and, according to them, poorly formed material world. Now, industrialization has everything to do with that. But even with that prejudice, human beings are not part of the natural order. Somehow, a certain class of adepts are above it. You see this in the Zohar and Kabbalah. Materialists have to say that everything that exists today had to have existed in one form or another the minute matter was created. The mechanistic idea, which, by the way, is an immediate consequence from materialism, if you say that the entire world and everything that we could possibly ever come into contact with is material and based on matter, then you ask yourself, there's only one way that change can come about. Said, well, what could possibly bring that about? And that is simple cause and effect. Whether it be the chaotic version or the simple linear version, I think in the public mind, in the mass mind, the version that we're most common is the linear idea. That most people cannot think unless they're thinking in the simplest possible linear terms, meaning that history and causation goes in one simple direction. And since the advent of industrialization and the Darwinist ideology that had to accompany it and that justified it, from primitive to advanced, and that word, I call them, my very first book, I call them slang terms. And usually having something to do with science itself. So the scientific revolution stated that progress comes from the scientific mind. But in the 20th century, did you get to the argument that the scientific mind justifies itself through technology? These are very simple approaches to history, but that's all most people can grasp. So you don't have an articulation of materialism, you have an assumption or implication of materialism. Bergson argues with, given his time period, he was in a privileged position, that the Industrial Revolution and its success and its ideology through Darwin and Spencer created the ideology of materialism, at least as a public phenomenon. There had always been materialists. An atheist has to be a materialist, or else the atheist has to explain where spirit came from. The opposite of matter is spirit. Now, I don't want to stress that too much. In fact, speaking of Seraphim Rose, he challenged that dualism by saying there are degrees of spirit. There's a coarse spirit. There's a more ethereal spirit. And that's a much older topic, too, which I fully understand. But spirit, however you qualify it, has to have an origin. It can't be matter, or else somehow spirit had to have been part of the material world from day one. And, of course, that just now begs the question, it just pushes the question back, where did spirit come from? Ultimately, what Bergson wants to do is stress the, you know, Heidegger did this, a lot of people did this at the time, and a little bit before, to stress the things, the aspects of humanity and human action that are not based on simple material cause and effect. And the fact that there are many things that are not part of that materialist cause and effect, that all materialists have to posit, because of that, there are things that science cannot talk about. If it's not material cause and effect, it is not a scientific question. Now, we live in an age of total and all-encompassing vulgarization. You know, there's another law, which I'm sure has been coined before, that whenever a philosophy, no matter how ethereal or how brilliant it might be, the minute that penetrates to the average, you know, the average guy in a bar, it will be mangled beyond recognition. You know, most people are not philosophical. They think in practical terms. But when a philosophy becomes a mass idea, it's going to be so manipulated and altered and simplified to the point where it renders it useless. And I do think that that has the capacity to be a law. So long as it exists in a very small class, as Plato would say, it could retain some variation of purity. The minute it becomes a mass phenomenon, it is almost immediately destroyed. So there are things, I don't want to use the word irrational, but there are impulses, intuitions in men that aren't amenable to cause and effect, and that also aren't amenable to conceptualization. Somehow knowledge has been, and this is a Heideggerian idea, has been defined in conceptualization. We don't know anything unless there is a clear term and definition that encompasses whatever it is that we're studying. In other words, the scientific establishment, by creating these concepts, then in fact creates reality as it goes. But that's not the myth of science. The myth of science is freedom of inquiry and objective information. I don't think they believe that for a minute. You have a few maybe younger guys who believe in the myth, but that was never the case. It's a highly closed caste, and then the popular mechanics or the popular science often differs greatly from what the specialists actually do. Science now is an ideological term. It has nothing to do, in fact, it's the very opposite of the scientific mythology of open experiment and wherever the facts go, we have to go. That's also, though, the difference between time and space. I didn't understand, when I first read him a long time ago, it took me a while to grasp this. The scientific cause and effect, the world of conceptualization, is based on space. And he's talking largely physics and biology. What often gets forgotten, according to him, is time. Time is, as far as human beings and their motives are concerned, is more important than space. He has a technical term. He calls it duration. It's almost the same word in French. And what he means, it's a constant accumulation of past things. Perceptions, events, thoughts. And this is not just an individual thing, this is at a species level, too. Now remember, this is before DNA was discovered. So he was more right than he realized. I'll say this till the day I die. It was only through brute force that the evolutionary ideology was able to survive the discovery of a DNA RNA. But duration is something that dispenses with space and is a lifelong and even historically long accumulation of all of this stuff. Things snowball over time. The past then bleeds into the present and then bleeds into the future. The past always endures, and in fact, our past, personally and otherwise, is the only way we could function. You think in terms of families and nations, too, especially if these past events are traumatic. I've argued since I was 25 that the nation comes into existence and has the emotional pull on people, the pull it has on people because of suffering, of mutual suffering. You say, you know, my wife and I have been through thick and thin together. That's really important because you're saying we're very strong, that we not only could endure all that, but we could learn from all of that. That doesn't hurt you. It, in fact, helps you. Our past is how we function. Now, the future can never be identical to the past for very obvious reasons. A long time ago, I think I was still in school, someone asked me about Adam and Eve and this incestuous concept of reproduction afterward. And I wasn't sure how to answer. And I came across a lengthy article talking about genetic errors. The past is, at least in a biological sense, encoded in DNA RNA. As ridiculously complicated as that is, it's inconceivable, but how complicated it is. Before there were many genetic errors, you know, like in ancient Egypt, brother and sister, albeit raised apart, could produce offspring. But because of this snowball effect, all of these errors, all of this, just the mess of millennia, makes now that impossible. So because of this accumulation of things, there's no way to repeat the past because either as individuals or as a species or as a nation, we're not the same from one period of time to another. The vehicle of this duration, with a capital D, is memory. As problematic as it is a vehicle. It retains the past, and because we have learned and understood so much, especially as we get older, we notice more alternatives. There are fewer alternatives when you're younger because you simply don't know anything. As you get older, and this has everything to do with societies because that's what tradition is. Tradition is a congealed experience. The same experience that makes us wiser as we get older makes societies better as time goes on. That's what tradition is. Consciousness is proportionate to the existence of choice. This is why I talk about him as an existentialist, which is very rare. When you choose something, that is the opposite of material cause and effect. Choice and determinism are two very, very different things. Maybe not necessarily total polar opposites, as some have said, but extremely different from one another. There's very little overlap. And of course, this aims towards integration with everything else. You see, this duration, the sum of contingency, everything that has happened relative to us, in one form or another, creates the possibility of future action. The materialist ideology is purely passive. You don't have any real control over it because all materialism could show you is basic, predictable, linear cause and effect. Therefore, your actions, which although it seems like you're choosing freely, these aren't free. These are as much part of this linear cause and effect as a leaf falling to the ground. It's a radically monistic and reductionist ideology. I don't believe that there are a lot of people who truly believe in that immaterialism. You can't have gradations in materialism. There's only one, you know, either everything in the universe is matter or spirit exists. However you want to modify that, there's really only one choice there. When you think that you're acting in the world, you are deluded. Freedom, then, to a materialist is a delusion. You can't be a materialist and believe in free will. Because then you have to ask yourself, what is it that's making these free choices, and on what? Everything has to be the result of mechanical cause and effect. But Bergson always said that, well, now that the machine dominates French and English life, we use that metaphor to talk about people and society. Parts of a machine, that's because you're surrounded by it, especially in the cities all the time. It's real easy to project that onto everything you come across. It's like today, the computer revolution of the last 40 years has led to a prejudice that, well, the human brain is just like a computer. Well, it's almost puerile, because the only reason you say that is because so much of our lives are governed by computer software. It's almost very lazy. And this seems to be the case throughout the ages. People use the dominant technology of the time to construct their idea of how a human being is to act. But that's ultimately passive. Materialism can't be active. It's simply one preordained mechanism. And yet, Bergson refuses to accept this. If freedom exists, then materialism is false. Man is active. Now, he has to then answer the question, what is it that grounds action if it's not material cause and effect? And the existentialist part of this is to say that whether it be the mass man or Das Man or whatever, you know, escapist ideology that these existentialists will come up with, we did the same thing with Kierkegaard, it's easier to believe everything is cause and effect, because therefore you don't have to think and you don't have any responsibility. That's why this is an existentialist point of view. Free will derives from the fact that our consciousness refutes the very idea of materialism. Memory is able to evoke past perception, which then continuously accumulate into our present world. Free will comes from this accumulation. Freedom derives from the fact, we'll get more of this here in a minute, that our knowledge is continuously increasing. We start to learn our options and what works and what doesn't. The more we learn, the more we experience, and then of course learn from that experience, the freer we become. Because we know what works and what doesn't, and therefore we can make a rational decision. But reason doesn't exist much in time. It exists in space. And he's talking about, you know, of course, the classical mechanics, the Newtonian universe, that, while again only existing in a vacuum, still, when you account for all the other variables in a normal world, still is purely cause and effect. As I said, I don't think most materialists really believe this, but it's a great negation. It's a great place to start, because it empowers those disciplines that can only deal with cause and effect, that is, the scientific establishment. But this experience, even though it's learned in time, once it's encoded in memory, it no longer exists in time. You think of a dream. Regardless of the origin of dreams, it does say something about consciousness. Because time and space both collapse entirely. In one, even a very brief dream, you could be in 10 different places, at 10 different ages, and in 10 different circumstances. And that when you picture a dream that you had, you see, whether it be whatever you're perceiving, comes from different parts of your experience. It can be compacted into one thought. If man is to rule matter, then freedom has to exist. And freedom ultimately comes from knowledge. So in this sense, he is kind of accepting a linear development, whether it be of the species or of the individual. Of course, it also implies that there's a motive force for even caring about this stuff in the first place. In addition, if the mechanistic idea is true, remember, you know, Marxism holds this dogmatically, that material things are the only things that exist, and therefore all you need to know is the ins and outs of production, and you can predict what's going to happen. That's the foundation of what we call social science. It's the same cause and effect that exists in biology. It's just now society, since really it's all matter. And if it's all matter, it's all one thing. And if it's all one thing, that simplifies everything. Because even the idea of chaos we've dealt with before concerns not a lack of order, but an extremely complicated order. But it doesn't matter. It still doesn't really, at least in one school, it doesn't dispense with cause and effect. If the mechanistic idea were true as far as our behavior is concerned, action should be easy. All other things considered, life would be easy if you were ruled entirely by instinct. Reason, consciousness, free choice, none of that makes sense if materialism is true. And yet, Bergson, 100 years ago, and to a far greater extent, you and me today, are surrounded by at least the implication of materialism. The idiot can point to cellular phones and satellites and these alleged trips to the moon and the Mars nonsense and say this is more advanced than 1,000 years ago. But of course, it's a circular reason. The truth is that none of this is easy. To be able to learn from experience, to understand duration, to have this intuitive insight into your experience and the experience of a society, it takes a lot of work precisely because it's easier to do the opposite. To be active is to be creative, but to be creative in the literal sense, not in our like artistic sense. That's a big difference between Russian and English. You refer to creativity usually as something almost artistic, but creativity is really any concentrated and extended work on something. That, of course, as I mentioned, requires work. It requires labor. The brain and the mind, or put it differently, the brain and consciousness are not identical. The way that the human organism is designed, if materialism is false, there has to be something like consciousness and reason, I didn't say logic, reason, that is not reducible to matter. The fact that we have a material vehicle is irrelevant. You know, the car may be our vehicle to get from point A to point B, but we're the cause of it, not the car. The materialist is going to say, no, the car is the dominant actor, or even the gasoline that you put in it. Consciousness needs the brain only because we are, you know, both mind and body. But the complexity of an organism, and to some extent, here he has a specific definition of progress, but only in the natural world. That complexity means a greater and greater division of labor. You know, a one-celled organism has no division, or it's extremely rudimentary. He talks about amoeba and stuff like that. But we are advanced animals in the sense that we have organs that all do a very specialized thing, and they have to work together. The nervous system alone shows this and is at the border between mind and brain. Consciousness then derives from this complexity. It's yet another specialized function showing that human beings are not particularly suited, according to the evolutionary design, to the current situation. We are very weak. We don't have fur. We don't have claws. A good punch will break every bone in your hand. That means there's something else. Not only is there an intellect, but the intellect isn't enough. There has to be something else. And this is, we'll talk about the Ilan Vatal, which is what he's known for in a minute. But it can't necessarily be logical. It can't be simply bodily. It has to be something else. And this comes down to intuition. He doesn't like when he uses intellect. You know, the ancients would refer to nous or reason. That is not the same thing as logic. But in the materialist universe, reason and logic become the same thing. Logic is something that humans develop because we're not particularly well suited to the world, like a cat would be, or a shark would be. Consciousness then developed for this very reason. Logic exists to make it easier for a human being to understand his environment and to create the tools necessary to survive in it. Because of that fact, there has to be a certain ability to reflect, and this becomes freedom. Freedom is something that developed in the course of human evolution. Now, we've got to be careful when we use the term. Evolution can mean several different things. But a very important division is between origins and simple development. To think that society doesn't develop over time is stupid. Or that within certain limits, different species, etc., they develop over time. That's unimportant in the sense that is completely, it's beyond debate. But it could also mean the assumption that everything is material. There's no purpose to this development. It is simply random interaction, which again is non-scientific. He talks to me now he accepts evolution, which is a little disappointment because it does derive directly from the same industrialization that created materialism. But whether or not he means that the theory of origins, which again is not just non-scientific but anti-scientific, the primordial soup, which believe it or not is not science fiction, it's actually considered a scientific object, that's simply an assumption to replace the idea of God. Now, what he means in this by talking about logic in the way that he does, it could never, first of all, it doesn't have, the intellect doesn't have its own motive force. You could know something is true, but that doesn't mean you're going to do anything about it. The intellect doesn't want to put itself into action. That has to be a separate organ altogether. And this is where, at least according to him, this is where the materialist and deterministic idea comes from. Because logic developed to make it easier for a man to connect with his environment, because we aren't suited to it naturally in terms of our physical presence. But that's just purely utilitarian. Knowledge really doesn't come from utilitarianism. The spatial orientation of human, and this goes back to, you know, a bit later to Heidegger, and the relative unimportance of time, the scientific mentality, which is a huge weakness, stresses the idea of both logic and utility. That isn't knowledge. Knowledge has an absolute character. But because of that, Bergson understands where the materialist impulse comes from. That one part of human beings that is a logical, utilitarian side. And really, if you're a materialist, you have to be a utilitarian. You can't talk about rights because you have to, again, explain where that comes from, and they can't. And you know, life, according to him, life is time more than space. Space is less important than time because we are a subjective people. Consciousness is something that is strictly personal and subjective. It's an objective truth. But the existence of a logical design
doesn't give us any reason to care about it. So again, if there's this fluid and constant creation, which is totally opposed to the implications of materialism, that has to be explained. What is it that does this? Our consciousness is our inward life. There is no matter there. There's no time there. There is no space there. When you think of the dream again, in one instant, everything that you've experienced, or many things you've experienced, is just shoved into one image. You know, I've gone through different eras of my life. You know, here I am, 51, and I'm in high school somehow. Time and space don't matter in this inward life. You know, dreams are maybe an expression of the subconscious, because our conscious mind isn't directing it. It is not based on the logic utilitarianism that forms the root of materialism and then eventually industrialization. He's very naive in this respect. These things didn't just happen. There is an extra element, which I think is basically the cabal of Freemasonry, that led to the existence or even the conception of mass industry. You know, very scientific and literate societies like ancient Greece and Rome never dreamed of the idea of this technocratic grid. Something happened in the interim. Something altered perception in the interim. The idea of consciousness, which cannot be a material thing, since it contains everything else. The brain can't explain a dream because these are three-dimensional things. These are complex experiences where the brain can only talk about synapses and chemicals. But there is an element far beyond just mere cause and effect and the logic that we need to get through the day. And that's the thing that can't be, you can only talk about metaphor. It resists all conceptualization. It's this motive energy. Ultimately, it's the Ilan Vatal. Now, the ability of consciousness to contain so many complicated things at once, without regard to either time or place, this almost a recapitulation of everything in an instant, the so-called eternal now, is what he means by intuition. It's the world taken as a whole. This is identical to the Russian intuitivists as well. Logic only understands bits and pieces of things relative to what we need at any given second. That doesn't produce knowledge. It's part of the accumulation of events, but it's only one small part of it. Intuition is this inner life. It's this constant interpretation of our experience. And again, the mass doesn't like this. The notion of mass society is the death of intellect. The only thing that survives mass society is a very crude utilitarian logic. Consciousness can't be, you can't speak of consciousness in the language of physics or mathematics. Physics and mathematics exist only in space. They do not exist in time. Just because they have a history doesn't mean they exist in time. There may be a development of the numeral 5 in Arabic and English. That doesn't mean the 5 as such is historical. It's not the product of development. It is not identical to instinct, however. So, you know, the object of spirit is this ethereal breath. And the two terms, of course, are closely related. The mind is a measure of things. Thinking requires an object, something for it to work on. But Bergson will say that these are very crass media. They don't lead to knowledge. Psychology. Think about the dream example. Psychology is an interior world far more comprehensive than the intellect. He does have a kind of a reductionist concept of the intellect. He doesn't make a distinction between reason and logic as the ancients did. Intellect and logic, brain, for him, are really one and the same thing, and they exist largely on the plane of space. Mind, psychology, the psyche, consciousness. At most, it will exist in time. Of course, it develops in time. But in fact, it doesn't need either. His conception of evolution can't be based on mechanism, and is not based on mechanism. He rejects Darwin entirely. The concept of the development of things is as old as human language. Darwinism is a specifically ideological approach to it. And not even Darwinism. It's really Spencer's. Spencer, Huxley, these the ideological, the mass inculcation of the ideology. Remember, this was accepted by an elite in British society before any evidence existed. This framework, in a very strange event, this framework pre-existed evidence. And this is the evidence that, or the proof, that this has nothing to do with science. But he's taking Darwin and Spencer, he talks about Spencer, in fact, at their word, and that material cause and effect is conceptualized by a materialist evolution. Now, if our center is this accumulation of vital powers, life, mind, and the creation of newness, still that doesn't explain where this impetus for survival and development and adaptation comes from. They know how it works, or they claim to know how it works. They just don't know what it is. Darwinism is based on natural selection, and Bergson is willing to accept it. But then where did instinct come from? There's a very puerile theory of evolutionary psychology, and I make fun of this in many different places. But it ultimately comes down to saying that there was a state of nature without law or language or society. Mankind somehow survived and functioned. It was purely through instinct. But then civilization over time is created, and those instincts don't work anymore. Because what you needed in a state of nature or prior to civilization isn't the same thing as what you need within civilization. But that couldn't have developed. That set of traits, man had to have been created with them. Because then there had to have been a time before these instincts came into existence. Then how did man survive? Again, none of these really are scientific questions. And the concept of l'âme vitale, this interior spirit in Plato's sense, is probably his best known contribution, and may in fact derail the entire Darwinian project. Instinct has to remain the same over time. Behavior can't be the product of evolution, because it only begs the question. This idea of blind variability, which is implied in Spencer's definition of Darwin, is a fairy tale in his mind. It doesn't explain the impetus in the first place. It doesn't explain the source of these laws that couldn't possibly have developed, which means that matter inherently contains these eternal laws of motion and of evolution. But of course, that's a contradiction. They can't claim that, because again, it only begs the question, well, where did this law-bound, and not just any law, but a law inherent in matter that permits a species to survive through these random alterations. None of that is explained. I mean, you could believe in... Anyway, well, I was, you know, you could believe in evolutionary psychology without believing in the primordial soup. And the point that Bergson's trying to make here is that what we now know as evolutionary psychology doesn't make any sense. Because we're talking about a time before civilization. There's no writing, there's no law, there's no evidence. It's largely an imaginary construct, like the primordial soup itself, where something sounds good. Like we needed hatred in order to survive and defend ourselves against others. Hatred now is a bad thing because we don't have to. We don't need that intense, powerful reaction to things. Well, that sounds good, I guess, but almost by its very structure, there can't be any evidence for it. The Ilan Vattal, again, probably his best-known contribution, tries to take all of this into consideration. And the Ilan Vattal is exactly, tightly connected, I shouldn't say exactly, tightly connected with duration and intuition. And none of it, it's not a scientific category. And I can't tell you the number of academic articles on him that criticize him because the scientific establishment doesn't accept the Ilan Vattal. You know, Plato didn't describe man as just reason and matter or passion. The soul is made up of three parts in Plato's world. Reason, which of course deals with eternal truths, non-material things. Of course, the material world, which is based entirely on nominalism and passion, you know, the desire to dominate. But there is a middle in between those two extremes. And I guess most translations call this the spirited part. And of all the literature on Plato over the centuries, that spirited part of the soul gets treated very little. And I'm almost certain that the Ilan Vattal is identical or very similar to Plato's spirited side. Now, the spirited side can lean to reason or passion, but it's the motive force that intellect doesn't have. Now, Plato's definition of intellect is very different than Bergson. I have the feeling that had Bergson lived at the end of the war, I can't remember, DNA was discovered in the late 40s. I think he would have rejected evolution entirely. He understood the scientific impetus that led to this ideology, and he knew it was an ideology. But it had so and has so many problems. There is a distinction between reason and will. For Plato, the spirited, that middle part of the soul, is willfulness. It's the motivation. An intellectual truth doesn't itself contain the drive, the desire to realize it, or to even care about it. A world of space, mathematics, physics, is purely passive. And yet we're not purely passive. There's something that fights inertia. There's something that fights entropy. In fact, what has to be explained here is this faculty that drives people to take huge risks. It certainly can't be understood through simple evolutionary development, because risks often lead to failure. It is not a survival skill. Gumilev, and we've talked about him on this show many times before, Lev Gumilev talks about the passionary. Passionary is that person in society, really only a tiny minority, whose belief in a cause is greater than his desire for self-preservation. These are the true revolutionaries in all senses of the term. They're willing to die for this. Dugin calls it the political soldier. Evolution does not explain this. There has to be something else that explains it. There is nothing about evolutionary theory or materialism in general that suggests activity or you know, that is to say, the opposite of passivity. Activity, inventiveness, creativity, and risk. In fact, life, if it can be called life at all, fights inertia. I mean, instinct remains a tool of the mind. But it didn't exist in this imaginary state of nature.
which evolutionary psychology has to posit. They even try to make believe that the so-called hunter-gatherer world is, well, that's close enough, so we can use that. And all they end up doing is projecting all these postmodern priorities onto these poor tribes that they don't understand. They don't even have the tools to understand. And, of course, the fact that these tribes are have a social structure that's extremely complex doesn't make them different from any so-called advanced society. There are certain things about human beings that can't be explained through the very simple evolutionary theory. And it is so simplistic, it's almost designed. You know, there was this huge PR campaign in favor of it in Britain after around the end of the death of Darwin. But there's a sub-rational part, or just a non-rational part of man that, and this is, again, this is racially based. For the most part, it's a tiny handful of Asians and white Europeans that are like this. The drive to explore, the drive to almost obsessive, to the point of death. You know, climbing Mount Everest, which I never quite understood, or even the space program, which I think is ridiculous. But there is this élan vital in a certain group of people, and even within that group, only a handful, that will drive them to, in some cases, almost certain death. And, of course, the masses don't understand this. They take it all for granted. They think it just happens. This is what the élan vital is. It's this urge. It's an urge that forces our growth, taking risks, being very creative. Life is the enemy of matter. And we see that his definition of matter, or the material world, also has a qualitative aspect. It has to do with inertia. The masses seek security. The passionary, those where the élan vital is very strong, seek growth to the point where they're willing to take tremendous risks. The lunatics that do cave diving, which, you know, if you're a cave diver, you should wear a sign saying, I'm going to die soon because of this crazy hobby. But that can only be explained, as crazy as it is. Climbing Mount Everest, there really is nothing to be gained by that. There has to be, but that evolution can't explain that. What is this? Of course, the scientific establishment needs the implication of materialism, so then there's nothing that science can't talk about, and therefore they're a totalitarian establishment. They don't like the élan vital. They don't even like the concept of reason. Élan vital has more in common with the ancient definition of reason than intellect in the way that moderns define it. We want to be free of this material security. Nikolai Berdyaev has a very similar idea. In fact, the core of his philosophy is that the objective world is purely material in cause and effect, and therefore you can find freedom in it. Consciousness and mind are a different story. Wherever you go, from Bergson's time up until maybe the 60s, this is a kind of existentialism that was marshaled against the Industrial Revolution. We want to be free of this material security, at least a small minority, the passionary. And in fact, it's shameful when someone is accused of simply following his interior cause and effect. It's shameful to exist without reason, although it's a very convenient way to hide. Intuition and the élan vital overcomes discursive reason. The élan vital is immediate. Of course, discursive reason or intellect by definition is immediate. In other words, it has steps. You have to go through it. The élan vital, like any of the spirited parts of our being, is immediate. It's not amenable to analysis. I'm talking about it, and he's talking about it after the fact. So he has, and this is well known, his one of his later works, Creative Evolution. There's four elements to his criticism. And the first is that there has to be an original common impulse, which is eventually becomes the human being that has a specialized, is a specialized organism that then has this consciousness separate from everything else. And the Alain Vital is responsible for this. There is also a diversity in evolution. That very different evolutionary processes led to an eye, whether it be fish, in the an ostrich, very different. Their environments couldn't be any different, and yet they both have eyes. That has to be explained. It's not sufficient to explain the development. And, of course, divergent tendency. Those divergent tendencies in human beings, the pinnacle of all of this, are, as we've said, Alain Vital, the instinct, consciousness, and intelligence. Intelligence is simply analytic and utilitarian, existing in the realm of space. Instinct, of course, is what we're talking about. I don't want to say that those two things are identical, instinct and the Alain Vital, but they're very close. And intuition, finally, is something that allows us to put ourselves in the presence of that Alain Vital. And that's the drive that has us make war on material comfort such that we grow and society grow. It's always the domain of a small minority. Masses, materialism, Darwinism, these are all products of industrialization. The concept of abulia. It's not just a matter of lethargy, but a matter of not believing there's anything worth fighting for, which is the disease of the modern age. Freedom is painful. It is so much easier to believe in materialism, because then you're not responsible for anything. You can just live for utilitarian pleasure, and nothing's your fault. The minute you start talking about fault, you're talking about spirit, freedom, and reason in the true sense. And the difference between these two things is that the intuition, which is a product of Alain Vital, instinct or a product of the Alain Vital, is a motive force. It grasps life as a whole. It sees it in without space and time. It's a comprehensive conception of the world, something that simple intellect and logic could never comprehend. Materialism comes from the belief that all human beings are pleasure-seeking, utilitarian, logical machines. Now, of course, reason is incompatible with that. But he has this analytic conception of discursive logic and intellect that's really just about utilitarianism, that which is useful for us. Intuition is its antipode. It can direct logic and reason, just like Plato's spirited part of the soul can give motive force to reason. Ultimately, knowledge can't be reached by logic alone. There has to be a reason for this. The intellect can't grasp the essence of a thing, which, of course, is very anti-Platonic, anti-Aristotelian. It the Alain Vital, which creates instinct and, well, really the whole duration idea, that can penetrate to the essence of a thing. This vital impulse. And he does say, just like Gumilev's idea of the passionary, that this kind of powerful Alain Vital, this instinctive drive, shows itself in times of great stress, in times of social disintegration. It's beyond categories. It's beyond. It's chaotic in the sense that we've defined chaos a few weeks ago. Matter and space and intellect, it seeks stability and equilibrium. The Alain Vital is the opposite. Remember, chaos is not disorder. It's a highly complex and intricate order that takes a lot of specialized study to reach.
absolute knowledge, in other words, knowledge that doesn't change, knowledge of the whole, comes from immersing yourself in it. You can't use category for the things like the Elan Vital. It resists categorization. The minute you categorize it, the minute you do a typology of it and analyze it logically, it falls apart. It's something beyond that. The world of spirit, however, is the world of intuition, the Elan Vital. It motivates the knight to rescue the damsel in distress, despite the fact that there's probably an 80% chance he's going to die or be terribly disfigured. It's a drive that is far more powerful than logic because it's immediate. Anyway, I've gone over my time. I appreciate everyone for listening. And as always, I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.